This episode is sponsored in part by the Pastor Theologians Conference. Each October, the Center for Pastor Theologians hosts a one-of-a-kind interdenominational gathering of pastors and ministry leaders from across the U.S., exploring some of the most pressing issues facing the church in today's complex world. This year's conference is called Good Shepherds: Pastoral Identity and the Future of the Church. In our contemporary context, the pastorate can often be shaped by visions of leadership that sometimes overemphasize method and technique. We can find this, of course, in church growth strategies, in business-based leadership models, and in social media influencer culture. It's easy when navigating all the details to lose the plot, but October 20th to 22nd, you're invited to Chicago to renew your vision and commitment to following the way of the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherds Conference will bring together a diverse group of pastors and ministry leaders to reflect together on how we can model pastoral ministry as under-shepherds of Jesus of Nazareth. Speakers include Kate Sonderegger, Matt O'Reilly, Doug Sweeney, Amy Peeler, and many more. Learn more and register at cptconference.com. That's cptconference.com.
But I said, let's go back to basics. All of us have taken the vow to pray. All of us have taken the vow to serve. All of us have taken the vow to witness. Let's go back to that, because we all agree on that.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back after a month's break from the podcast. We have certainly enjoyed a break. We hope that you have taken some time to maybe go back in the archives and discover some episodes of the Living Church Podcast that you have missed in days of yore. We go back to 2020, so there's plenty of episodes in the archives to catch up with whenever we take a break. But I'm also glad to be back. Glad to be back in the saddle with a new production team, Chad and Jess. You'll be hearing their names in the outro now, instead of our former wonderful producer, Leslie Thompson, who has gone on to other green pastures. Now, if you are listening to this podcast, my very safe guess is that you are an Anglican or an Episcopalian. If you're not, love that you're here. Welcome. Please hang out with us crazy, wacky Anglicans and Episcopalians as long as possible. We learn so much from one another. But if you're an Anglican or an Episcopalian, you might have a group of women at your church, a very special group of women. There may be a couple, there may be dozens of them, and they tend to handle your prayer requests. They tend to do things around the church, probably largely unnoticed, helping support your pastor, helping support programs in the church, helping support a lot of the ministries that just need an extra boost. These women are often known as daughters of the King. They are a specific ministry that we're going to talk about today because I decided to invite on the show their past president, Dr. Grace Sears, who led the community through some difficult times, and we can learn from that as well. The Order of the Daughters of the King is a vowed order for women who are communicants of Episcopal churches or churches in the historic episcopate. So that currently includes women around the world who are in Anglican, Episcopal, Lutheran, or Roman Catholic traditions. And daughters take vows to obey two rules of the order, the rule of prayer and the rule of service. They aid their local clergy and parishes in prayer and evangelism, and they do it all while wearing a simple silver cross, the cross of the order. So if you see one of these crosses glinting upon the neck or lapel of a woman in your church, watch out, buddy. This is a simple but powerful call that this woman has taken up. In my humble opinion, when a daughter of the King but clears her throat, Satan and his minions tremble. Our guest today is Dr. Grace Sears, as I mentioned, and Grace is past president and archivist of the Order of the Daughters of the King. She's also past editor of its magazine, The Royal Cross. The Daughters of the King Archives Suite at the Margaret J. Franklin Center in Woodstock, Georgia, has just been named the Grace Sears Archives Suite. So you get a sense just from that of the kind of impact that our guest today has had. She's also past vice president of the board of the Living Church, where I got to know her. We'll talk today about being taken by surprise by a calling, about learning leadership, especially when you feel you're not ready for it, about navigating controversial times, and what happens when the Holy Spirit falls in a business meeting. Grace asked me to ask you today to particularly notice the themes of commitment and solidarity in our conversation today. What can we take from a group of women who simply vow to pray and serve together, no matter their own season of life or what's going on in the life of the church or the world? Now, get your hand-embroidered kneeler cushion handy, because you may be inspired to renew your own commitment to prayer today. Maybe even join the daughters. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Do you have any questions for me today?
How did you get into podcasts?
Oh, a biographical question. How did I get into podcasts? I was told to, in no uncertain terms, when the pandemic started, I got an email from Christopher Wells. He said, we need a podcast stat. And I said, I'm too busy. I can't do that. And he said, yes, you can do it. So I grumbled for about 20 minutes. And then I started researching what it would take to do a podcast. And I got really excited really quickly. It just seemed to really fit with a lot of the things that I enjoy. That's how I got into podcasts.
Great.
Grace, it is a great pleasure and a privilege to have you on the show today. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
I'm delighted to be here.
When did you become a daughter of the King initially? And I'm also curious how you were attracted to this ministry.
I became a daughter of the King in 1995 at the Church of Our Savior in Madison. Well, it's in Richmond, Kentucky. I had been in a prayer group in Berea. I was vicar's warden, is the term at the time. I knew the church needed prayer, so I wanted to get the dormant Daughters of the King going. So they got going, and then they said, why don't you become a Daughter of the King? And I said, but then I did.
So it sounds like maybe you grumbled or hemmed and hawed for 20 minutes, and then you... I see we have something in common. Once you jumped in, was it sort of love at first prayer meeting, or did it take some time?
Well, we always ask for 3 months of discernment when a woman expresses interest. You don't have to join after 3 months of discernment, but hopefully you will and take your vows, because they're lifelong vows and you need discernment to do that. So I took my vows, and the president was... At the time, she wasn't the president, but she was a member of the chapter. She had been president of the assembly of all the Daughters of the King chapters in Lexington. And she nominated me for president of the Daughters of Lexington. That is, all the chapters together are called, form an assembly. I didn't know what I was doing, but I said yes. And that brought me into touch with leaders all across the Southeast, because the presidents of all the assemblies would get together at least once a year. And they trained me, basically. It was an apprenticeship. And I was deeply impressed. First of all, I was impressed by the fact that there were Black women in leadership in that organization. And that hadn't occurred to me. It wasn't the case in my assembly. I was also impressed by the fact that there was an international reach, an international dimension to the order. I was just really impressed by the triennial. The last one in Lexington was, I think, at least 600 women. There were some excellent speakers. There were some excellent workshops. The new presiding bishop came and said hello. You have wonderful worship services. And if you have all that many women in one room singing together, it's pretty impressive. And I really enjoyed that. It's not just a business meeting, although there is a business meeting, and there's an election of the new council every 3 years.
It sounds like pretty quickly you were drawn very deeply into leadership. It reminds me of the stories of church fathers who never want to be ordained, and within like 6 weeks, someone wants to make them a bishop. So it sounds like this was a pretty quick process for you. Did you come preloaded already with a passion for prayer, a heart for women.
I knew I wanted to follow Jesus from the time I was 5 years old. So there was that to start with. I had been raised to believe. I'd been raised to practice faith. I had gathered in other contexts that I had some leadership talent. I wasn't raised in the Episcopal Church, but I thought the Episcopal Church had room for women leaders. That was one of the attractions. So I knew I had that talent and could use it, and I was using it within my church at that point. So I was rather surprised when I got elected the first time around in 2003, because there were only 15 elected each 3 years. And I thought, not enough people know who I am. But the people that did, I guess, talked me up. I don't know.
You mentioned you knew you wanted to follow Jesus by the time you were, since the time you were five. Was that a particular something that happened when you were five that sparked that in you, that sense of vocation?
My grandparents, my parents, you know, your Sunday school teachers, I was picking up Christianity by osmosis, kind of.
In a Baptist tradition or?
In a Presbyterian tradition.
Presbyterian, okay.
And one evening we were traveling, and my mother usually said prayers with me at night, all right? But I had seen the grown-ups saying prayers silently, and I said I wanted to pray silently like them. I think she was skeptical. But I did pray silently, and then after I prayed for quite a while, apparently, she asked me what I was praying. And that's why I remember it, because she asked me. I said, I thanked Jesus for dying for me, and I knew it was terrible that he died, but wonderful that he rose again. And so I thanked him for forgiving me and making me his child. I think people underestimate kids when they when they tell Bible stories, etc.
But also Daughters of the King, I did not know this when I started doing more research into the daughters, is that there's a junior Daughters of the King. So this is girls and young women between 7 and 21 who can be a junior Daughter of the King. So one thing that I appreciate about the ministry of Daughters of the King is that they do take children's and young people's spiritual development seriously.
Yes, it's a very important part of the order, and it goes all the way back to a lady named Mary in the 1890s, and she had a passion for teaching girls to be daughters of the King.
That's beautiful. Did you yourself ever discern any other kind of order or being ordained?
My big ambition when I was about 12 was to get a PhD or be a novelist, one or the other. So it didn't have anything to do with being a minister.
Nice.
But I never have felt called to ordination. I think I'd probably be, there's just enough of a mystic in me that I get lost in the service. And I think I would probably forget what I was doing if I was up front or drop the chalice or something horrible. So I've preached a few times. That's as far as I've gotten.
As the years pass, you know, you're rising in leadership in the Daughters of the King, much to your own surprise. And now I'm curious about the journey to you becoming president of the Daughters of the King. Did you feel prepared for that role? And in what ways did you feel prepared or not? Or did you have to prepare? What was going on around that time?
2003 was when I was first elected to council, and that was also the year that Jean Robinson was made a bishop.
Yes.
And there was a lot of fallout.
That was a wild year.
And the fallout was still affecting the daughters 6 years later when I became president. The women on the council were just marvelous leaders, and I learned from all of them. But there were two in particular that I think made a difference in my future thinking and acting as president. One was a Roman Catholic daughter, and she was brilliant at math and finance, and that I learned a lot that way. But she explained the finances of the order in a way I could understand it. She also explained how she had fought for Roman Catholic daughters to be recognized as full members. Roman Catholic daughters had been accepted since 1988, but not at first as voting members. And in the 90s, they said, look, we take the same vows, we pay the same dues. Why are we not considered full members? The other I remember particularly is Deborah Akajaya. She is a Nigerian. She's a geologist. And every time her job took her to another African country for her work, she would look up a bishop and his wife and say, you need Daughters of the King in this diocese. And she started chapters in Ghana, in Kenya, in Nigeria. Not all of them have survived, but she had a vision for the global reach of the order. And that was communicated to me, and I kept it.
And that became, I think you told me in an email that became particularly important to you, that there were actually a couple areas of the Daughters of the King ministry that became particularly important to you. And one of them was the global reach and global chapters. And then the other one is the way that Daughters of the King has been used by God as an instrument of Christian unity. You've seen it be a boon for the work of Christian unity. I mean, you even just mentioned the Roman Catholic sister, ... And that was a surprise to me too, when I was doing more research on the Daughters, is that you're not just Anglican. There's also Lutheran, there's Roman Catholic, there are other denominations. In fact, one of the requirements to be a junior Daughter of the King is a Christian in any Christian denomination. So how have you seen Daughters of the King serve these things that you've been so interested in? Could we start with Christian unity and what you've seen there?
Well, it's a complicated story, actually.
Yes, we love complicated stories here, please, Grace.
And actually, in the founding, Margaret Franklin founded the order. She was a Sunday school teacher, but she already had a vision for a global vision, because she wanted the order to embrace our Anglican sisters. And there was a Canadian chapter founded before the first convention in 1891. And there were a bunch of international chapters founded the first 30 years or so. But that, what with World War I and World War II and the Depression, all of that went away. And I think the Daughters kind of forgot it for about 40 years. However, in the 1980s, a missionary we supported in Brazil founded a chapter of Daughters of the King in Brazil. And then there was a student of music in the Sorbonne in Paris who founded a chapter at the American Cathedral of Paris. And, you know, suddenly this vision began to revive. And a Roman Catholic priest in Kentucky saw what the Daughters of the King were doing in the Episcopal Church in that town and said, I'd like to have them too. So we changed our bylaws in 1988 to allow for, we put it, women who are eligible who are in churches in the historic episcopate, but not in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the beginning of having Roman Catholic chapters. And we had quite a few, actually, until Gene Robinson was elected and the Catholic Church started to back it off from the Episcopal Church. However, at that time, churches were leaving the Episcopal Church and joining ACNA or whatever intermediate version there was of ACNA. And they argued successfully that the same clause applied to them. They also were in had a historic episcopate, but were not in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury. So that became an enormous controversy between 2003 and 2009 when I was elected to presidency. And that was the great division that was going on at the business meeting in 2009. So, you know, we sort of fought to a standstill during that business meeting. First, the Anglican and the Roman Catholic delegates were unseated. There were enough votes to unseat them. Then alternate bylaws were proposed. None of them passed. And then somebody got up and said, well, we haven't changed anything. So the women we unseated are still eligible. let's bring them back. And they did. And the interesting thing is, the Roman Catholic leader that I mentioned went to the microphone and said, I'm calling on Margaret Franklin and all the saints to come with us and bring us through this. I don't remember her words exactly, but that was the tone. A profound prayer. And another council member at the back of the room told me later, she said, I saw the Holy Spirit come. It changed. Everything changed. And the daughters got, the choir started singing while we were counting the votes. And people got out of their seats and danced all the way around the auditorium.
What?
And I was taking notes. I was a secretary. When that all ended, I was, you know, I was like a rag. And the chaplain got up and said, I hope you all can live with each other until 3 years from now.
Hey, everybody. I'd love to tell you about our next Living Church conference that you don't want to miss. It's in St. Louis in November, and it's called Awe and Presence, a conference on worship and the arts. What do worship, going to church, or the beauty of the Christian liturgy have to do with real life? You can explore with us through art, literature, music, and history how sacraments and sacred rhythms usher us into the awe and presence of the one who is good, true, and beautiful, and forms our lives to his. Speakers include Malcolm Geit, W. David O. Taylor, Abram Van Engen, Grace Hammond, and Matthew Ulver on poetry, prayer, the body in worship, what it means to worship with the church of the past, and understanding the story we're in. Go to livingchurch.org/events for more info and to register, or click the link in the show notes today. And if you register now, you can get a 15% off early bird special. That's livingchurch.org/events, or click the link in the show notes. Grace, you had a Pentecostal hoedown in the middle.
Just about.
In the middle of, this provokes a question for me. That is an amazing story, which involves revival and Robert's rules of order and counting votes and arguing about things. In case, lest we forget, are not separate, hashtag, you know, Council of Nicaea, 1700th anniversary this year. I'm curious whether you've ever been asked to speak to an issue regarding Anglican unity or the union of the communion, and used your experiences at Daughters of the King as an example of God meeting people and helping them resolve disagreement or synodality, or have you ever been called to use Daughters of the King as an example of how Christians can survive these times?
The answer is no, but...
Well, we're doing it right now, Grace.
We're doing it right now. I've used it within the Daughters of the King, certainly, because this was a major thing. And of course, it was a major challenge to me, because I had to deal with the two challenges I had to deal with healing that division. Because I had a council that was not all, 15 members who were not all on the same side. And the other challenge was the international development. Something else kicked in, and this is why I often say, God prepared me. I wasn't aiming at this, but God had something in mind, because I had been through a denominational split when I was a kid. It totally disrupted our life.
Yes.
I think it was deeply influenced by politics, because the McCarthy hearings were going on right that time. My father lost his job and went to start another seminary. They obviously felt betrayed and hurt by friends. I mean, my father's best friend was on the other side.
Ugh.
So I had just watched them deal faithfully with this devastating situation. Not understanding, but, kids pick up all the emotions.
Yeah.
And so that experience kicked in. I didn't realize it was happening until about halfway through my term. I thought, oh, yes. I remember now. So that there were some deep down memories that were, I think, part of my ability to cope with it. But I said, let's go back to basics. All of us have taken the vow to pray. All of us have taken the vow to serve. All of us have taken the vow to witness. Let's go back to that, because we all agree on that. We have to pray together. We have to serve together. So I got us a place to, it was a kind of a shelter that had started up for women nearby where we were meeting in Atlanta. And we went and cooked a meal for them and ate with them. And our first council meeting included that. So, you know, that really helped. I knew we were going to have two splits. One was a group of women who were going to form an Anglican, you know, a sort of an ACNA. They formed the Daughters of the Holy Cross, which is under ACNA. And then later, there was another group that split off. They called themselves the Episcopal Community. And they represented the women who thought Daughters of the King was Episcopal only. So they both went. And I attended, you know, I attended the foundation of the Daughters of the Holy Cross and said, go with our blessing. We want to be friends. I attended the other one. They didn't ask me for my blessing, but I was there anyway. And then we moved on. And then we had this great challenge to work with International Daughters. So that was, I had a wonderful international chair. It was really, loved the job and did a great job. I had a couple of financially savvy people who I sent out to find out how to handle endowments. And that's how we finally got a stream of funding for international development. Let's see, I visited Brazil, I visited Malawi. And when I got to Malawi, we got through customs. And there was a whole group of women in blue and white to welcome us. They were Daughters of the King.
I'm not asking you to pick favorites, but I am curious whether you found yourself in your heart being drawn to a particular international chapter of the Daughters of the King.
Every single one I visited was really attractive. I mean, I went to India later, and that was wonderful. And I went to, I told you I went to Brazil, and one of the fascinating things is the way Daughters is adapted and integrated into the culture of the church and the community there. Malawi is a great example. As Daughters of the King, every year you pay your dues, right? That's how we finance the order. In Malawi, they don't pay dues, but they have self-denial rallies. So they all get together and they hear speakers and they sing and they dance and they pass the hats and they collect their money. That's the way they do it, because that's what suits them and fits them. They have developed for evangelism a remarkable way of, they call them crusades, actually. And I saw a little bit of it when I was there in Malawi. We were at a celebration of the first missionary who brought the gospel to Malawi, which they celebrate once a year. And the Daughters of the King from two dioceses, they marched in with, and they're all wearing their uniforms, and they're dancing, and they're singing. But they regularly do it as an evangelistic tool. They will go, a lot of them will get together. They'll march and sing into the center of town. They'll have some more singing and speaking. It's who we are. This is what we do. This is the good news of Jesus Christ. And then they split up and go around and talk to people. That's what they do to evangelize. And it's very effective.
Wow.
I'm told they also have all-night prayer meetings. I don't know how often.
Oh, my gosh.
So, this is why I say we have a gift in the Order of the Daughters of the King that we're called to share. And we have a way of being Daughters of the King. As you said, we have a culture of Daughters of the King in the Episcopal Church in this country. But the basic pattern is discipleship, women discipling women. And it's very adaptable. So you go to Guatemala and hear these women who are visiting the old people and the sick people. You go to Mexico and they're on the front lines visiting these desperate people on the border who need help and food and all kinds of things. So each place is different. And this, because it's basic Christianity, because it's adaptable, it grows. I mean, even in Cuba, it grows. And that's wow. One of the most astonishing stories. I mean, I haven't been to Cuba, but I met a daughter from Cuba at this past triennial. And she is doing wonders. Hmm. How she does it, I don't know.
Well, something that occurs to me in all these descriptions, Grace, and in these stories, is the immense freedom of the different chapters of Daughters of the King, and also the freedom given to the groups who wanted to split away. So thinking about the ecumenical side of this, both in terms of disagreement and in terms of growth into other countries and growth across the globe, I don't know if this is something you all have consciously taken up, but I see freedom as being a real thread here.
I don't think we had consciously taken it up, but yes, I do think that's true. It's true. And it is possible partly because we're, we are a parachurch organization. We're like the Living Church. We're autonomous. Mm-hmm. While we're based in the Episcopal Church, we started there. We're free to branch out. We're free to make our own rules about how we go about it. And that's a great strength. The women who started it, they were inspired by the Brotherhood of St. Andrew, partly because the Brotherhood of St. Andrew was a lay ministry. There were other women at the time in New York who were forming, not exactly convents, but either deaconess or sisterhoods that were more like a Roman Catholic order. But that wasn't open to women who were married.
Hmm.
And Margaret Franklin was married with children. And she was said, okay, the Brotherhood chose us. We want to deepen our relationship with Christ. How can we do that? And how can we do that as people, lay people in the world with all the responsibilities we have? And I think that's the great gift, to find a way to do that. And to find a way for women to support each other in doing it. And it's empowering. I had an interesting experience. While I was president, I went to a group of leaders of women organizations in the Episcopal Church for a couple of days. And I went, and I thought, here's a woman who leads Asian Daughters, and she's the daughter of the king. The outgoing president of the Women's History Project is the daughter of the king. I think at that time, the head of ECW was a daughter of the king. I thought, we ground women and enable them to do other things. Because, as you very well know, it's easy to get burned out in a tough job if you don't have that grounding, if you can't tap into living water. So that's an insight that I've held on to, that Daughters of the King may be the beginning of another ministry, preparing women to do something else that they otherwise might not have the strength or the grounding to do.
Mm. That is really such a beautiful and a helpful description. I'm so glad that those thoughts came to you. Because one of the things I was thinking, as you've been describing different women that you've met in your time, I just keep thinking to myself, I have not heard you describe a single one that I thought, boy, she's a real slouch. I mean, you wanted to be a novelist or get a PhD when you were younger. And then you describe a woman who is a geologist and travels internationally in her work in geology. And other women who are in administration, who are in science and mathematics, who are in the humanities. And I know that not every woman in Daughters of the King is an intellectual. I mean, that's not a requirement for being in Daughters of the King at all. But there's just a sense in which, everyone who's in Daughters of the King or who remains in Daughters of the King is very serious about her life in Christ and serious about making the most of her life and being fruitful. And I think how to be fruitful, whatever world we're given to live in, how to just do our best and know and be grounded in God's love at the same time is just a challenge for everyone. I'm curious whether you have seen not the ministry of the daughters change, though maybe, but is there a way you've come to view the ministries of prayer any differently as you've seen things in the world change? You know, we live in a time now that is deeply skeptical on the one hand and deeply credulous on the other hand. Who is telling us the truth? Who should we believe? What actually makes a positive difference in the world? Whose side is God on, if there is a God? So how would you see prayer ministry and the ministry of the daughters of the King addressing our times? And is that any different from how you've seen it address other times that daughters have lived in?
I organized an Advent retreat around prayer for peace this last fall, with stations of to pray for refugees and to pray for forgiveness and to pray for, you know, things. And particularly certain countries where, you know, where the hot wars are, but also for peace in our communities, in our churches. In preparing that, I looked at two kinds of prayer that have impressed me. And one is Daniel's prayer for his people. Daniel is, you know, this courageous, righteous man who is willing to face the king's wrath rather than give up praying. But he prays for forgiveness because he's identifying with his people. Hmm. And he says, Lord, forgive us for all the things we've done wrong. As an intercessor, he stands before God, like Moses stood before the people of Israel, praying for forgiveness for them. There's also the passage in Ephesians that I've gone back to several times lately, where Paul talks about the armor of God. And he talks in particular, he says, all prayer is one of the weapons of the soldier of God. He also says, we wrestle not with flesh and blood, but with principalities and powers and evil in this world. So I think we're very quick to say, this person is a problem. That country is a problem. But Paul says there's something else going on that we don't see. And when you pray, pray against the evil forces, the evil powers, not consigning particular people to hell, although you may feel like doing that.
May they fall in a well and never get out or whatever, you know.
Right, right.
Those have bubbled to my mind a few times, I'll admit, Grace.
But I think the prayers need to go beyond the specifics of the situation is what I'm saying.
I have a final question for you about your own retirement from being president of the Daughters of the King. When this episode is hot off the press, we will also have a retirement issue of the magazine that'll be hot off the press. And so I'm curious what was most on your mind as you approached retirement as president of Daughters of the King. I would suspect there are some people listening who are themselves approaching retirement or have recently retired. And I would just guess that one of the things on someone's mind during this time is, what have I done? Have I done well? Hopefully not, what have I done? But, what, you know, more like, what have I done? What fruit have I borne? Have I done well? What kind of questions were you asking yourself? And maybe where did the Lord reveal to you the fruit of your labors? You know, how, yeah, what was revealed to you as you asked those questions approaching retirement?
Part of my answer was my final moments as president at the 2012 triennial, because we had a peaceful business meeting. We raised the dues by $5, and raising dues is frequently something people oppose. We passed a bunch of bylaw amendments, not terribly consequential, but there were 12 of them. And I'd been saying for months that it took an act of God to get even one through. So I said, I have my miracle. We had a peaceful business meeting. We accomplished things. We had international guests, and my international chair was elected president.
Wonderful.
And so I said, okay, these two priorities, bringing peace to the order and advancing the international development, those are on track. That's not that they can't be derailed, but those are on track. And I thank God for bringing me there.
If someone's listening who is in a place of doing of a major vocation transition or a major job transition or retirement, and they're thinking to themselves, you know, darn it, I don't clearly see that fruit that I would have hoped to see. I don't see that what I thought the Lord put in me to do has really been done. Or actually, I see that some things are kind of a shambles, you know, and I'm not sure what I would have done differently. Or is there something you might say to someone who's in that position to encourage them as they look back over their career?
Well, God doesn't ask us to succeed necessarily. God asks us to be faithful. And God asks us to trust. I'm sure that my father saw his 19 years of work founding and teaching at a seminary as in shambles when he was kicked out. And he had to start over with, you know, not that much money and a new place. Well, the seminary he started the second time is huge and flourishing. He had another career as a translator of the New International Version. This was an extraordinary thing that he probably would never have done if he had stayed where he was. And I look at that and say, God didn't forget him. God didn't push him aside. It looked like disaster, and it was at the time. But God specializes in bringing joy out of dark places and fruit where it looks like a wilderness, water in the desert. And that's what I would say to somebody who's really discouraged looking back. You know, I haven't had happy endings for all the things in my life that I put energy into. But I've been greatly blessed, and I'm greatly thankful for that.
I've been speaking today with Dr. Grace Sears, who is the past president of the Daughters of the King and its retired archivist and past vice president of the Living Church Board. Listeners should come on down and visit the archive sometime in Woodstock, Georgia, and it's a beautiful time of year to do it. Thank you so much, Grace, for coming on and being with us today.
It's been a joy to be with you. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning into the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. Don't forget to visit livingchurch.org/events for our latest conference, Awe and Presence, where we'll explore how worship works through the arts that play a part in liturgy and devotion. Don't miss that gathering in lovely St. Louis, Missouri. In 2 weeks, join us for a conversation with Pastor and Social Development Officer Natalie Arenza and lawyer-turned-ethicist Elizabeth Kincaid on facing legal injustice as Christian leaders. Until then, our producer is Chad Snavely, our production assistant is Jess Collins, and I'm Amber Noel, your host. It's been good to be with you. Peace.